Good evening and welcome to Climate One at the Commonwealth Club. I'm Greg Dalton, the founder of Climate One. Our guest today is David Orr, Paul Sears Distinguished Professor of Environmental Studies and Politics at Oberlin College. He's the author of many books and is perhaps best known for spearheading the design, fundraising, and construction of the Environmental Studies Center at Oberlin College. The Department of Energy called that building one of 30 milestone buildings of the 20th century. His latest book is Down to the Wire, Confronting Climate Collapse. Please welcome David Orr.
Greg, thank you. And thanks to the Commonwealth Club for sponsoring the public dialogue about climate change. There is, in many ways, a huge gap between the science dialogue on one side and the public policy discourse on the other. And so thanks to the Commonwealth Club and Greg, to you and all your colleagues. I'm going to describe the book very quickly and some background. And for the last several years, I've been involved with climate at three different levels. The book Down to the Wire is the 35,000-foot view overview. What does it mean for us to live at this particular time in human history? The second level, at about, say, 15,000 feet, was a project that several of us got together, which is called the President's Climate Action Project. You can go to climateactionproject.com and download most of the materials. But we set out 3 years ago to develop a climate action plan aimed at the first 100 days for the next U.S. administration, be it Democrat or Republican. And so the final report is a document about 4 or 5 inches thick that includes everything from the legal powers of the president relative to the issue of climate change without climate legislation, all the way down to personnel appointments and so forth. But it had 13 major chapters and looked at virtually everything that would be on the next president's desk, which, of course, is Barack Obama. At ground level, the project, and I'll conclude a few remarks this morning about what we're doing in Oberlin to develop a climate-positive city, a town of about 12,000 people in Ohio, located about 35 miles southwest of Cleveland, 14 miles south of Lake Erie. a couple of remarks on climate change and the nature of the book. Opinions on climate, of course, vary widely. Jim Lovelock, who is arguably the best independent scientist in the world at one end of the spectrum, believes that we basically bought the farm. And Jim, in arguing this case, believes that there may be no more than 1 or 2 billion people by the end of the century, that the best place to live is going to be Scotland because the warming and the interruption of the North Atlantic conveyor will basically cancel themselves out. But how you get a couple of billion people into Scotland is an issue. At the other end of the spectrum, the default setting, I think, in our culture, partly because we're Americans and we have a certain bias and worldview, is that climate is a solvable problem. And so between these two bookends, since this is the rational debate about the issue, between those two bookends, we can kind of pick and choose your own views. In trying to think about the issue, the first warning, when we did the work for President Obama, the first warning to a U.S. president was given 45 years ago. It was 1965. And then subsequent warnings to the president about climate change and what it might mean were given at regular intervals. And, of course, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, now 4 reports. The 5th report is in the works. But imagine if we had, in 1965, gotten a warning that the Soviet Union was going to make a doomsday device and it would operate sometime in the 21st century. Imagine the different kind of reaction we would have had had it been identified as a national security issue committed by a dependably loathsome enemy. But we didn't act. And so we're now in 2009 still at this point without a de jure climate policy. In lots of ways, this issue has been characterized as the perfect problem. And it has been. There are reasons why we have not been able to come to grips with it, and I think more so in the United States than in most of the rest of the developing world. If you're old enough, you remember Walt Kelly's cartoon series Pogo, and he has sometime in the late 1970s, Pogo, who is a muskrat or possum in the Okefenokee Swamp, is cogitating about environmental issues, and he comes to the conclusion we met the enemy, and he's us. And, of course, carbon, the heart of the climate change issue, is implicated in virtually everything that we do. You have a carbon footprint. I do. San Francisco does. Oberlin, Ohio does. We all live by virtue of cheap carbon as an unpriced problem. So it is a perfect problem. And for us, it hits us, I think, culturally at a very difficult spot. Culturally, we are Americans, we're optimistic, we love machinery, we're good at it. At our best, we are technological virtuosos, and so by definition, anything that comes along is fixable by some gadget or some better gadget. The nature of the issue, however, also hits us where we're weak. Science education has not been one of our fortes. If you read poll data and you discover that half of the American public or some such percentage believe in alien abduction and don't believe in evolution and so forth, you can see we've got our work cut out for us in trying to educate the public about how the Earth works as a physical system. And then there's another issue, and this is a particularly tough one for us. If you read the science, it's evident that there's about a 30-year time lag between what comes out of our tailpipes and smokestacks and the weather, the climate change-driven weather effects that we see. So it's not like most issues where cause and effect are tightly coupled. These are tight; they're very uncoupled, and so there's this 30-year time lag. And in the fourth IPCC report, the science conclude that time lag will drop to perhaps 20 years as oceans acidify and the uptake of carbon by oceans decreases. And so there is this, on one side, lag between what we do and the effects that we see. And on the other side, there is a long lag, and I began down to the wire with a quote from David Archer, who is a geophysicist at the University of Chicago. And David Archer says words to the effect that the effects of loading the atmosphere with carbon will last longer than civilization, longer than Stonehenge, longer than time capsules, longer than nuclear waste. And so we're now dealing with an issue, the effects of which will last for not necessarily decades or hundreds of years even, but perhaps for thousands of years. Susan Solomon, in an article that appeared in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences in January of this year, indicates the same thing has been said before by others, that if we were by some miracle to stop emitting carbon immediately, sea levels would continue to rise for 1,000 years. So we've created a situation that the implications are now spilling well into the future. How do we think about this? Well, one way to think about this, if you happen to be biblical, is that we're evicting ourselves effectively from the only paradise we've ever known. And if you have a PowerPoint slide, it's easier to depict this. But imagine a band of temperature ranges extending back about 10,000 years. And that band had the climate and weather fluctuated, clearly as it does normally. But in that band, that's what the geologists call the Holocene. And that's the time at which we became what we are as humans, for better or for worse. That's our history, our poetry, our triumphs, our failures. But that's the era in which we became as we now are human. And so as we load the atmosphere with carbon, we're creating conditions the likes of which we have no evolutionary experience. And so we're effectively, in kind of a biblical way, evicting ourselves from this paradise called the Holocene by geologists. That's one way to think about it. You know, Wilson describes this as the coming decades as a bottleneck. And 7 billion of us are coming into this era and coming out the other side of this. We don't know how many people will be on the planet. Jim Lovelock, again, predicts maybe 1 or 2 billion, but we don't know. James Howard Kunstler refers to this era as one of what he calls the long emergency. But by whatever name, it is the most unusual period in human history. And it's a convergence, as John Platt, the futurist, said many years ago, of a crisis of crises. So it's the end of the era of cheap, portable fossil fuels. It's a population surge. We were 1 billion people on the planet in the year 1800. We are now 7 billion, more or less, and we will probably surge to 8 or 9 billion before population crests and begins a natural decline. So how do we think about this? And in the book, I tried to address this in a number of ways. The default setting for Americans is to see this primarily as a technical issue, solvable by better gadgetry. And it certainly has a technical side to it. Do we need better ways to generate electricity and to sponsor our mobility? Absolutely. There's no question about that. But it is a bigger issue, and salvation by better gadgetry won't get us home free. There's a second way to think about this, and that is simply as an economic issue, that if we can just price carbon, then all else will improve. And it certainly is an economic issue. Nicholas Stern, the author of the Stern Review that came out in 2007, commissioned by the British Exchequer, Nicholas Stern argues that this is the largest market failure in history. And in a certain sense, it certainly is. But it was before that, it was, and a third way to see this is as a political issue. This was the largest political failure in history long before it was a market failure. We had warnings that date back to 1965 at the White House, and we knew something about the effects of carbon in the atmosphere all the way back to Savanti Arrhenius' work in 1897, in which he took, he was in the midst of a very tough divorce, and he took his marital anguish out on making some of the most incredibly tedious statistical calculations by hand. This is long before the era of computers, and he got it just about right. But we've known about the issue for a long, long time. So this third way to think about it, beyond the technical aspects of it, and beyond the purely economic aspects of it, are the issues of governance, which is to say how we conduct the public business. And not to preempt what I've said in the book, but as a political failure, it has several parts that are really obvious. Why didn't we respond to this sooner? And the fact that we didn't respond to it sooner means we've largely spent our margin of error. We didn't have room for a lot of error in this. That 30-year time lag between what comes out of our tailpipes and smokestacks and the climate change-driven weather effects, that's the 30 years in which we should have been acting. So there's a capacity to respond to a variety of things. We know that climate change means a number of things. It will be headline events. If we have, let's say, two or three Katrina-scale events, we'll ask the federal government to step in and relocate people and help people and communities recover to the extent that recovery would be possible. With rising sea levels, in the fourth IPCC report, the number was still put at something like 40 centimeters sea level rise by the year 2100. As the report went to press, and when the members of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change won the Nobel Prize for their work, quite rightly so, the group as a whole thought that the report was already outdated, that the evidence of sea level rise was such that it was more like a meter or 2 meters sea level rise by the year 2100, not just 40 centimeters. So how do we relocate people in low-lying areas? The last time in the United States we tried to do anything on land use at the federal level was 1973. It was a bill that was to provide money for communities that wanted to plan, develop plans at the state level, and that was defeated. And that had no teeth in it anyway. Had it passed, it was just to provide planning money for states that wanted to do these things. So how would the federal government begin to take on this task of relocating people? And if some of the projections are correct, much of the Midwest will be hotter and drier. Agriculture will disappear. The Southwest and areas like Phoenix will become simply uninhabitable. How do we relocate people? Where do they go? This is clearly a matter of increased, enhanced, not just market capability, but governance capacity. And then there are other issues. Toward the end of the book, I talked about issues of rights. In the case where one generation can deprive subsequent generations of the right to life, liberty, and property, and that's the wording of the Fifth Amendment and the 14th Amendment. It is clear that climate change, among other issues, but notably climate change, imperils the rights of future generations in ways that are fundamentally political. But in this case, they have no voice, unless it's your voice and mine, to say that we have to constrain our behavior to accord with their fundamental rights. So this takes issues that we thought we had debated in the Federalist Papers and in the U.S. Constitution and puts them back on the agenda as intergenerational problems. And then there's a fourth way to think about this, and in the documents that we put before the president, Teddy Roosevelt coined the phrase the bully pulpit. And the use of the White House capacity as an educational vehicle, as a place where you could raise the IQ of the public on all kinds of issues. So we recommended that the president give a great deal of attention and personal leadership to this issue, and even go so far as to give, let's say, the climate equivalent of Franklin Roosevelt's Day of Infamy speech given in the wake of the attack on Pearl Harbor. But beyond that, James McGregor Burns, the great historian in a wonderful book called Leadership, which was written some years ago, talks about the difference between transactional leadership on one side and transformative leadership on the other. And we try to argue in this document, and I try in Down to the Wire, to say that this is a time quite clearly for something beyond simply transactional leadership, which is kind of more of the same. It's tinkering with the coefficients of the problem, not the structure of the problem. And transformative leadership goes at the structure of the issue. So we made a plea for that. A couple of comments at the end of the book. There is the issue of the word hope. And somewhere between, if you're optimistic on this issue, you just don't know enough. If you're in despair, that's a sin. You can't go there. So somewhere between despair on one side and optimism on the other, there is this condition of hope. And I defined hope as a verb with its sleeves rolled up. Hope means to be active and to be engaged and to be working, not in the assurance that you're going to win the game, but in the assurance that you're doing the right thing. And none of us know, given the severity of what lies ahead, what simply is described in the science, that we will, in fact, come through this. But we typically like optimistic people. We like optimism. It is reassuring. I think in this case it is not an entirely appropriate response to the magnitude of this issue. And yet we can't go the other direction and go into despair. I said in the book that hope is rather like being a Boston Red Sox or a Cleveland Indians fan. And you've got two outs in the ninth inning, a runner at second, a 200 hitter at home plate, and Mariano Rivera in his prime throwing smoke from the mound. And you can't be optimistic you're going to get the hit that gets that runner in from second base, but you can, and you should be hopeful. And so as a Cleveland Indians fan, that's a whole other topic, and I'll not get into it. That's about original sin and all kind of other things. but how do we envision the future? And let me close the discussion of the book with simply a comment that looking at this issue and an adequate human response to climatic change and this convergence of this crisis of crises, how do we begin to reformulate things? Mahatma Gandhi, in his work on nonviolence, appears much in our culture as kind of an Eastern oddity and a thing that a kind of response that maybe it was a nice thing, but it's certainly totally impractical. And I made the argument that, in fact, nonviolence toward humans and toward the natural world is now our only realistic option. We've tried all the others, and this is a time to think of a higher level of realism instead of the kind of realism we've had in the past. The conclusion of this, getting back down to ground level, and in some of the advertisement for this talk, my day job is back down at ground level in Oberlin, Ohio, a city of about 10 or 12,000 people with a great college, Oberlin College, the first college to accept African Americans in the United States and the first college to admit women back in 1833. And it has a great conservatory of music. It turns out more young people who go on for careers in the sciences than any other comparable liberal arts college in the country. So that's my advertising plug for Oberlin College. Great school. We're the college and the city are engaged now in an effort to do several major things. One is to redevelop the downtown as a green district. And so everything we've heard about green economic downtown development is part of the plan. Secondly, take the town not just to carbon neutrality but to carbon positive state, generating more power from the combination of efficiency, sunlight, renewables, and so forth than we actually use. And then thirdly, to develop a 20,000-acre green belt around the city as a place to restore local agriculture, forestry, and a variety of other industries. And then do this as an educational venture, but also as an economic venture to create working models of what post-cheap fossil fuel prosperity really would mean. So with that, let me turn it back over to Greg.
Our thanks to Professor David Orr for his comments here today at the Commonwealth Office. We have a number of questions, but first I have to ask, what happened in 1965 when someone went in to present Lyndon Johnson? Did he have some salty reply about climate change?
You know, I don't know, but knowing the little I do about Lyndon Johnson, I expect he did, and it was probably deleted with lots of expletives.
And then how about the Presidential Climate Action Project? Let's talk a little bit about that. What were the specific recommendations, and how were they presented to the Obama administration, and how are they doing so far?
Well, on the first part, we met with the president in November of 2007, the candidate Obama in 2007. We met subsequently with John Podesta, who headed his transition team. We met with actually both transition teams. And we brought in a number of people, national security experts, and in one very poignant point in the conversation, a flag admiral turned to both transition teams in a room about this size and said, if we thought the Cold War was a security issue, we've seen nothing yet. He said, beyond some point, we can't defend the United States. And very, very poignant. So the education started with dialogue with the transition teams and then with the...
That's with both transition teams in the same room.
With both transition teams in the same room. And I'll tell you, Greg, you could see... I looked over at the faces of both teams, and they really didn't know how to process this. How do you message that to the public? And they obviously didn't try. The campaign, neither campaign really dealt with climate change as a serious issue, I think. On President Obama now, I personally would prefer that he would have taken on climate first, health care second. But that's, for whatever reasons, that was not the decision. He's now got his work cut out for him. Copenhagen is coming up in December very quickly. The United States does not have a legislation. We have some bills, the Kerry Boxer bill in the Senate, Waxman-Markey in the House, and but we don't have a policy yet. So this is a United States still does not have a position. So I'd give President Obama on this yet. Well, I'd give him no grade at this point. I think it's too early to tell exactly what he will do. I would hope, though, that he weighs in on this issue with something, again, like the climate version of the Day of Infamy speech. The public needs to be told what lies ahead. And it's so easy in American politics, as all of us know, is to defer something, the consequences of which are 5 or 10 or 20 years into the future or farther. So this is not a time for politics as usual. But I don't think we know yet what the president is going to do.
As long as we're grading politicians, let's talk about Al Gore. He has a book out recently that talks a lot about the gadgetry that you mentioned.
Right.
What do you think of his approach right now?
Well, you know, Al Gore, for me, is a heroic person. I mean, he stood up on this issue. Inconvenient Truth is a great piece of work. He mastered the science and then mastered how to actually get this out to the public. So for me, Al Gore is a heroic person. I hope that he writes one more book. at least on this subject, about governance, because I think this is an issue of governance first and foremost. It wasn't a market failure first. This was a failure of in the way we conduct the public business to set the rules around markets, to begin to price carbon and do the things that we knew how to do. Back in 1951, the Paley Commission report projected a U.S. future in which by, say, 1990, I believe it was in the report, something like 20 or 25% of American power would be generated from renewable sources. And we didn't do that. But we had the possibility. And it wasn't because it was out, it didn't work technologically. It would have worked technologically. It was politicized out. Cheap energy and the power of oil and coal companies, which of course still exists, deferred that American future. That was our margin of error to avoid the worst of what could lie ahead. And we simply didn't act on it. So I hope Al Gore, who is clearly to me a heroic figure, but I hope he writes one more book on governance, because we have to now do in governance what we will find very difficult to do, and that is to create systems of governance that are calibrated to the long term and also figure out how we conduct a public business in a way that calibrates with or works with the way the world works as a physical system. And those are not first and foremost market issues. Those are governance issues.
So specifically, what kind of governance reforms would you suggest be in that book, or what do we need to do to have more long-term thinking? We have two-year election cycles in Congress. We have a very short news cycle. We have short memories. How would you suggest changing? What specifically would you suggest changing to get more towards a long-term view in governance?
Let's go to your next question. all right. Well. Very quickly, I think and Al Gore did address some of these things in his book Assault on Reason. We've got to get money out of politics, and by whatever name, campaign finance reform, we've basically tinkered with that issue. And I think we need the same separation of we have between church and state, between money and politics. There's a second thing that I think we've lost control of the airwaves. And in the FCC Act of 1947, the fair and balanced phrase that Fox News, of course, has co-opted, people who have access to the public airwaves, which are your airwaves and mine, are required to present all sides of an issue. And if they didn't, they could lose their license. And that has been that's been lost. In the rights of future generations, politically, we need some way to think about how to extend protection to the unborn. And there's an interesting convergence between the debate that we've had over the last 20 or 30 years, well, since Roe v. Wade, the rights of the fetus and the rights of unborn. But in this case, the issue is about aborting whole generations of people, of destroying the capacity for life itself on the planet. But the arguments are not so dissimilar. So there's a room for, I think, a much larger debate about life and how we protect it and what that means for laws and governance.
You also talk a little bit about natural capitalism and the idea that aligning the market can be marshaled in more constructive ways. So let's talk about your view of what, first might want to say what natural capitalism is.
Well, natural capitalism is a theory. It's a wonderful book put out by Amory and Hunter Lovins and Paul Hawken. And it came out first about 10 years ago. It's a new edition that is coming up on the web now. It's the theory that if we extend the thinking of capitalism to include what is called natural capital, soils, forests, wildlife, and so forth, and we see that as capital to be protected, and simply extend the logic of capitalism over to the natural domain, that things will work out. On Monday, Wednesday, Friday, I'm all for it. On Tuesday, Thursday, Saturday, I just don't think it's going to work. On Sunday, I rest. And the problem is this, that capital, as it is typically regarded in business, is factories and money. And those operate by the laws of greed and smartness. On the other side, there are two other kinds of capital that they deal with in the book. Human capital, you and me, people, and natural capital, which is soils and forests and so forth. But those operate by laws of affection and foresight. And the theory is you can pull these together and it all works. If you just price soils and so forth, it'll all come together. Their book, Natural Capitalism, is a brilliant book. If you haven't read it, I strongly recommend it. It's the best thing I've seen. And is there need for a new economy? Absolutely. New economic thinking? Absolutely. How do we get the prices of things right? Is certainly an issue. But the prior issue for me is how do we want to get the prices right in the first place? And that's a change in how we think. That's a change in paradigms, in mindset, in the categories of thought. So when I teach that part of a policy class, I include natural capitalism, and I also include other readings, including people like Joel Cavell, a Marxist theorist that is very opposed to it. I don't think we know yet what the economic challenges, how we're going to meet those kind of economic challenges. But quite clearly, we've got to get the price of energy right. That is a big step to get a price on carbon. But as far as a roadmap into the future and see what the economy, let's say, a sustainable and sustaining economy of the year 2100 would look like, I don't know. But it certainly would start with getting the prices right.
But you do think that markets have a role? I mean, are you talking about something, a new system other than capitalism, or just changing the way that the market forces are played out? Not clear how far you want to go with it.
Well, we live in an era of failed isms. Communism failed. Socialism is thought to be a failure. Capitalism, as Vaclav Havel said, will fail. Just give it enough time unless we change things dramatically. Greg, I think the only thing that I could say is this, that in thinking about the whole society as, say, the proverbial three-legged stool, one side of that is going to be commerce and markets. And clearly we need markets that work. And we've been through a pretty rough year and a half since the collapse last year. We found it. Even Alan Greenspan admitted that he found flaws in his thinking, that, foxes shouldn't be allowed to guard chicken coops and so forth. But that's another issue. But we now know that the economy didn't work right, that we were not nearly as rich as we thought we were. But in a weird kind of way, if I can divert here just a little bit, we were perhaps richer than we thought or knew we were when we thought ourselves to be merely wealthy, and referring to neighborhood connections and creativity that exists within organizations. So it gets me real quickly to the other leg of that stool, which is civil society. It's organizations and NGOs, and it's the Rotary Club, and it's churches and civic organizations. And then the third leg, which is often dismissed, I think, by proponents of natural capitalism, is governance. It's getting the politics of things right. And it's only governments that can tax and wage wars and get you into the kind of mess in which we now find ourselves. That is a whole series of governing failures. So I think this has to be regarded as a three-legged stool. Capitalism, I think, can be reformed. But to do that, it will take a strong, engaged government doing what governments do best, and then it's also going to take a citizenry, that civil society, that third leg, and an engaged and sometimes enraged citizenry to force the changes that we need.
Our guest at Climate One today is David Orr, Professor of Environmental Studies and Politics at Oberlin College. Question from the audience. Is the planet on a warming trend, perhaps regardless of collective human activity, and can we really stop it? So it's the anthropogenic question. Partly.
If the answer is no, we can quit. The planet is should be actually in a cooling phase. But the problem with heat-trapping gases, no matter what phase the Earth is in, if we're in a cooling phase, heat-trapping gases, primarily, there are roughly six very potent ones, carbon dioxide being the most important. But it would be retarding the cooling. If we're in a warming phase, it's amplifying the cooling. And so the record of CO2 in the atmosphere and other heat-trapping gases is, and we now have a very good record, the science is very clear on this. It goes back about 600 and some thousand years in terms of the ice core record, air bubbles trapped in ice. And that record is very clear, very definitive. There's not really much debate about it. Weaken the rules of evidence a little bit, and you can extend the record back another roughly 600,000 years. Weaken a little bit further, and you can take it back maybe, 5 or 10 million years. But what we now know is that since we've been on the Earth, the level of carbon dioxide has never been higher. The background level was around 280 to 290 parts per million. And we were roughly at that level in, say, the year 1890 when Savanti Arrhenius began to do his calculations. We're now at about 390 parts per million. And so we're loading the atmosphere, and we're running this what somebody described as a one-time experiment with the planet. Jim Hansen, who is arguably the most prominent climate scientist in the world, Jim Hansen last year published a paper in which he said that 350 parts per million was the safe level. And the reason is fairly obvious, that the longer we linger above 350, the greater the likelihood is that we will trigger these long-term, remorseless, and irrevocable, for our purposes and our sense of time, climate effects, most of which have to do with methane. So warm the oceans a bit, and we release methane, which is locked up in seabeds and as methane clathrates. Warm the land a bit, and you release methane that's locked up in boreal forest and tundra soils. And we know that both of those are, in fact, happening. And methane as a heat-trapping gas is much more potent than carbon dioxide is molecule for molecule, although it doesn't last as long in the atmosphere. Now, some of the climate science here, you can see people when you talk about things like this, people's eyes glaze over. And one of the issues here is we have to think our way through this issue. These are complicated things, and we have got to create the public capacity to understand the science. I mean, I'd love to see President Obama go to the public and kind of the way Ross Perot did once, you know, my fellow Americans, and have a flip chart or PowerPoint presentation, but walk us through the science, much as Al Gore did, not in as much detail, but give this the importance it's due. And we will have to think our way through this. And the other part of the question is it resolvable? Well, frankly, I don't think we know that. I think we've run quite inadvertently a major gamble with the way the Earth works. And so this gives not reason for despair, but every reason for as rapid change as we can possibly make. If this was a war, I think that we need to deal with this with a sense of wartime emergency. We need to deploy much better technology much faster. We need to make market changes and so forth. But instead of at the pace we're doing, which is actually for us pretty rapid, I think it needs to be still much more rapid.
You mentioned that Richard Branson, the British entrepreneur and industrialist, mm-hmm. actually is backing something called the Carbon War Room. So people are starting to use that term and use that language as sort of a war on carbon. Another question from the audience, sticking with science, is the American population's inability to grasp the climate problem cause and effect of our ignorance? Or do many Americans just lack the ability to understand science? Or perhaps the scientists maybe aren't doing a good job of communicating it.
You know, there are two. Again, Al Gore's book, Assault on Reason, I think is a good place to start to answer that question. And a recent book by Susan Jacoby called simply The Age of Unreason is a great book. And I think we have to reckon with something about American society. We've been highly distracted. The average American watches television on average, we're told, something like 4 hours and some minutes a day, and reality TV shows and so forth. And we've clearly been distracted by lots of things that are not very important. And I think the how do we get out of this? I don't know. I think that we, in many ways, the younger generation of students I see at the college level are transcending this. They're engaged in some surprisingly effective ways. There's a very robust greening of the campus movement and carbon neutrality movement on college campuses. And I think even in high schools, I think their young people are beginning to weigh in on this in major ways. But I think this is an issue of science education and everything that we can do to improve science education K through 12 would be to good effect. So the people, nobody comes out of school at 12th grade or 4 years of college without knowing how the Earth works as a physical system and why that's important to them. We think it's important to teach the basics of economics, and I think it is. But in this case, we don't do a very good job teaching essentially the basics of how the Earth works as a physical system. And that is, I think, bedrock reason why we haven't responded.
California's about to come out with a revised curriculum, K through 12 curriculum, that actually incorporates climate change and some environmental issues, which I believe is the first time it's done that, an integrated curriculum for all grades, including climate and other scientific issues.
That's a great change.
Fewer and fewer people believe that climate change is a problem despite the climate and the reports. Can this be changed, and why is that happening?
Boy, good, great question. Unfortunately, the poll data from the Pew poll and Gallup polls recently, I believe, have both shown that the percentage of Americans that believe that climate change is a real issue has dropped from back down to 55% from what it was, maybe 71% or whatever the number might have been, but it's dropped significantly. And we know that as temperature, it's been a fairly cool last several years, and so people's concern about climate drops pretty dramatically. It rises when heat goes up and storms increase, but it drops when we're in one of these little dips in that upward trend line. So, again, I think that this is an issue of education, to equip people to understand how the Earth works as a physical system. We're continuing to load the atmosphere with carbon. And so the trend line jiggles like a lot of things statistically. So there, as the line goes up generally, there are going to be some drops in it for reasons that have to do with complicated physical phenomena like El Nino and La Nina years and so forth. But this is an issue, again, of basic education. We have to do a much better job equipping people to understand the way the Earth works as a physical system and why this is important for California and Ohio and in all of our lives and our children. But this goes back to education and some major reforms. It's great to hear that you're responding to this here in California. Maybe we will in Ohio someday.
Another question from the audience. Jim Hansen rejects cap and trade, and writer of this question uses the spelling used on Jon Stewart's Daily Show, where Captain Trade actually was a person, like Captain Crunch, and says he favors Jim Hansen favors carbon fees and rebates instead. Do you agree? Please explain why. So it's the cap and trade versus tax.
When we went through this on the Climate Action Plan, we had both sides. John Holdren, who's the president's science advisor, came out very strongly for a tax on carbon. Most of the people that were part of our effort, there were about 250 of us, were for cap and trade, largely because in the political discourse, it was more acceptable than a tax. Tax has kind of become a four-letter word. So we split on it. My personal opinion is this, that either one would work. The virtue of a cap is you get a fairly, if it's properly administered and enforced, you get a certainty of result. If you cap emissions at 400 parts per million or whatever the level is, and you issue only permits to the large polluters to emit that much, then that's what you get. Taxes are a little less certain. So given what's called the elasticity of demand, it's not clear what level of tax gets what level of response. But having said that, I think it is possible that either one would work if we wanted them to work. And so the issue is the seriousness of commitment, the capability of administration in trying to enforce these things. But years ago, in 1976, in the transition to the Carter era, a group of us got together, Amory Lovins and Dennis Hayes and a number of people got together and drafted for Jimmy Carter what was called the Wolf Creek Statement. And in that document, we recommended a tax on energy to be administered at the mine mouth, the wellhead, the port of entry, and then let the effects of that ripple through, but basically a severance tax on energy. That clearly didn't happen, but I think you could make either one work. And it, to me, in an ideal world, what would happen would be something of both. You set a cap for the big macro sorts of things, but you use taxation to fine-tune the response together. But I think either alone could work. The question is the willpower and the determination as we administer either of those systems.
One of the premises of cap and trade is the use of offsets, and that's where I think a lot of critique comes at cap and trade is the offsets. Are they really real? Are they accomplishing anything? Or are they just kind of a scam, really? So did you debate that in your group about offsets, and do you have any confidence in offsets?
Well, we did debate it. And for me personally, when I get down to ground level with offsets, the Oberlin City project, I want the offsets to be visible and verifiable and a place where I can go see the effects. And the problem with offsets...
So that means not in Brazil somewhere? Means.
Well, you know, Greg, what goes on in Brazil, how do you know? So if you buy X tons of offsets by something happening in Brazil or in Africa or whatever, how do you know that it actually occurred? So if it's tree planting, how many trees got planted, how many survived, and did they in fact get planted? And so offsets are, I think, a useful device, hopefully fairly temporary, but what we're trying to do in our project I described is to develop offsets locally, ways to invest into the economy locally so that you can see what you get. And this is a case where local climate policies, I think, are particularly useful, where you can actually take money and invest it locally, get offsets, and in fact, but you can see the results.
Another question from the audience is, energy efficiency has been described as the low-hanging fruit of our dual energy and environmental challenges. However, most energy use is not efficient. And how can what are the barriers to energy efficiency, and what can be done to surmount them?
Well, great question. We know that efficiency is the fastest, cheapest, best thing to do. In the election campaign in 2008, however, it didn't really factor. And I think there's something very American about that. The cheapest, best thing we can do is to conserve, but there's something about us that's always been about increasing supply. And so the dialogue is on, well, it's on clean coal. And if you believe that, well, we'll talk later. And then nuclear power and increasing supply, and nuclear has always been a very expensive way to boil water. But to say that we have to go toward efficiency, and the studies show, the McKinsey reports that have come out, McKinsey, a business consulting company, the last report that came out several months ago showed that we could save, I think the numbers were, 23% of our energy use by the year 2020 at no net cost. And you've seen the McKinsey diagrams. It has a flat line here and lots of things down here that represent different technologies and design techniques. Below that line is that they're free. And then above the lines, you get up to maybe 4 or 5 cents a kilowatt hour equivalent. This side equals that side. And the point of all that kind of complicated diagram is to say that there is a lot of low-hanging fruit. What we've lacked so far is a way to deliver efficiency to businesses and residences and organizations. So one of the things we're trying to do in the Oberlin Project is to figure out a way to deliver demand-side management. And you in California, Art Rosenfeld and other people here in California, pioneered demand-side management a long, long time ago. And so I always, when I do talks on this, we'll show the graph from California showing your energy use basically on a residential basis, basically flat, that in the United States at large rising. Your economic growth until recently a little faster than that nationally. So you have to explain those two gaps. And it's an interesting story, but this means policy changes that give priority first and foremost to efficient use of energy and then figure out how we deploy that. And you've done more here in California on that than certainly the rest of the country and certainly my state of Ohio.
And I think the recent federal stimulus bill also had some things on efficiency. That is, to every year the United States subsidizes heating oil for people living in houses with lots of cracks and inefficient insulation. And this time around, I think they funded some insulation, thinking that it's better to pay to insulate the house because we're going to have to subsidize less fuel in future years. So hopefully, we're getting some things on the federal level as well. Our guest at Climate One today is David Orr, Professor of Environmental Studies and Politics at Oberlin College. Question about developing countries and how they fit into this and whether they ought to make deeper cuts or they ought to be given something given a break in terms of the path to a low-carbon society.
Well, boy, that's a hot issue politically going to Copenhagen. And it's hard for me to... imagine being a member of a third world country and needing to develop and looking at the United States, where our carbon emissions are around 22 tons per person per year, and their emissions are down under 3 or 4. In the case of Bangladesh, probably around 1. So this is a major issue. And it's for us, it's a wrenching decision because it means, again, that climate change is the, in the words of a number of reports from CNA and the CIA and other security organizations.
That's the Center for Naval Analysis.
Naval Analysis, yeah. It's the largest security challenge that we'll face. And yet it is not one that is solvable by tanks and bombs and airplanes and so forth. And so the roughly $1 trillion that we spend on war fighting and on military expenditures is virtually useless in this sense of security. So we're over a barrel, pardon the pun on that, we are in a rough spot because the third world can sink the boat. If China and India and any combination of countries decide not to play ball, their emissions could eventually destroy us. So this is a classic case of the tragedy of the commons, as Gerard Hardin once described. And it means that we will have to accommodate demands in the third world for sharper reductions than we have yet considered. When George Herbert Walker Bush said the American way of life was not negotiable, I mean, that will go down as one of the more remarkable statements made by an American, right up there with Custer's last recorded words at the Battle of Little Bighorn, which were, "Hurrah, boys, now we have them." Osama bin Laden alone, on one day, in a matter of minutes, negotiated American way of life downward dramatically to the tune of trillions of dollars. So I think we have to learn that we're part of one world. One other comment on this is to say that it would be a mistake for the third world to try to replicate our manner of development. The technology is much, much better now. And instead of going to centralized power plants and nuclear power plants and so forth, distributed energy in the same fashion we have distributed computing. And the technology permits them to go there. So the one thing I think that we can do that would make a dramatic change is to help deploy advanced technology globally, starting with places that need it most. And that's money that I think is as a much wiser investment for security than money spent to buy military hardware in this country.
One technology that some people think should be deployed globally is this idea of geoengineering, whether it's sulfur in the atmosphere or pods on the ocean that reflect light. And that's become quite a hot issue these days is geoengineering, whether that's folly or whether it's going to be necessary because the political process is not achieving the cuts that the scientists say we need. So what's your take on geoengineering?
Well, we don't know much about it, do we? The people who propose it can't tell you exactly what it does. It's tinkering with a large system. It may be that we will come to the point and be desperate enough that we'll have to take desperate measures. But that means that we will not have done all the obvious things beforehand, like improve efficiency, like deploy solar and wind, and like being able to redesign communities where we build access in and mobility out. We have lots and lots of options. We by and large know these things pretty well. I think the last 4 or 5 decades, we have built the intellectual capital on which to make a different society, and one that isn't doom and gloom and sackcloth and ashes. But we know these things. The question now is rapid deployment with kind of a sense of wartime urgency. But geoengineering raises lots of issues, tampering with the planet. And then there are questions of what happens if you decrease sunlight. Well, you change rainfall patterns. And you begin to incur lots of other things that ripple through the... And what's needed here, and this goes back to education, is an understanding that we're dealing with complex systems. And so we need to understand the complexity of this thing and lots of unintended consequences, and there are step-level changes. But if we don't do the things that we know we must do that are easy and cheap and quick, like efficiency and like renewables, then we may come to the point where we have to do geoengineering. And that will be a very unhappy day. And there will be lots of, it may work for part of the world some of the time, it may work for none of the world any of the time. We just don't know. And the basic research on geoengineering has not been done. So it is a shot in the dark. It's simply an unknown unknown thing.
Do you think we should continue that research as a hedge into geoengineering, just in case?
Well, the longer we wait on everything else, the more the greater the risk we'll have to do desperate things. Should we research it? Absolutely. I think we should know what to do. But if you have a choice of spending dollars on geoengineering or dollars on efficiency, mitigation or dollars on efficiency and renewables, in my mind, will always be the best thing to do.
One thing that the sulfur in the atmosphere won't address is the acidification of the oceans. And we have a question here. Is there any hope for avoiding the death of the ocean? So let's talk about oceans, which we haven't quite touched on yet.
Well, oceans are acidifying. And if you had tuned into the scientific debate 12 or 15 years ago, it was described as a problem that was maybe 200 years into the future. And now we know it's here now. And the pH of oceans is now trending to the high sevens. That's a logarithmic scale, so every drop is a order of magnitude. So we're moving in a direction where the death of the oceans is a plausible event. We know that, for example, 90% of the big fish have been taken out of the oceans, and the ocean ecology is dramatically different now than what it was 50 years ago or 100 years ago. And ocean acidification, of course, affects everything else, the uptake of carbon, ocean life, reefs, and so forth. So ocean ecology is changing dramatically. The problem for the oceans is that there is no ombudsman or advocate, by and large, for healthy oceans, except a few scientists. And international organizations that deal with it have yet been unfunded or underfunded. And it's one of those things that's out of sight and out of mind for us. But oceans are they are in jeopardy. And serious people who know the science and study these things for a living do talk about the death of the oceans.
We're getting towards the end. A couple last questions here. You've talked a little bit about both, but I'd like to draw you a little bit in terms of order of preference. Are you more focused on national, international politics or individual decision making? So is this going to happen from the top down, bottom up? A lot of people say both, but where do you think the real change is going to come from?
Well, it has to come from all of the above, doesn't it? I mean, the way I see the way I read the science, there is on one side of this chasm, there's a scientific dialogue. On the other, there is the public discourse. And they don't match up. And so you start with the fact that we've got to raise the level of public discourse. And Al Gore did address this in Inconvenient Truth. The minimum that is politically possible doesn't even begin to approach the what we have to do that's scientifically necessary. So this is a time for, I mean, in California, a young man by the name of Eric Lorz, L-O-O-R-Z, a few months ago, I met Eric, and he's all of 15, but at age 12, he began a climate blog and began to organize his peers to do climate action things. And he will make a lot of waves before he's finished, all the way out to people in the AARP organizing retirement homes to move toward energy efficiency. But the people in the Senate, international agencies and organizations, this, frankly, it's all hands-on-deck time. We need everybody. We need pressure from the bottom up. We need genuine leadership at an historic level. A good bit of down to the wire, I try to define the kind of leadership that we need. But it's moral leadership, and it's clearly, I think, in my judgment, transformative leadership, not just transactional leadership. This is time to go after the system changes that are necessary, not just the coefficients at which things get worse.
Are there any transformative leaders out there today?
I think there are many of them at all levels, and there are certainly in my domain in education, there are lots of people working in colleges and universities that I would call transformative. In business, Ray Anderson, the CEO and founder of Interface Carpet Corporation, Ray is clearly transformative. In his book, Confessions of a Radical Industrialist, is a record of a person who is a transformative leader in industry. I think Al Gore is a transformative leader. But they're all over now. And I think if I had said, if you'd asked that question maybe 10 years ago or 20 years ago, the answer would have been probably not at this point. But there is now a genuinely global movement that's gathering steam and gathering momentum. Several weeks ago here in San Francisco, the Rocky Mountain Institute held one of its solutions gatherings. And it was a huge gathering. And it's extremely bright people, very dedicated, working on all kinds of issues. But I can't imagine that gathering being held here or anywhere 20 years ago. So there is a movement, a transformative movement around the planet now, literally millions of people acting in all kinds of areas. And at the international scale, one of the things that Richard Branson, since you mentioned Richard, the formation of this group called the Elders, which includes people like Vaclav Havel and Desmond Tutu and Nelson Mandela and B. Robinson and so forth, we need those voices as well. But this is a time, I think, of real transformation. But it's a race now. H.G. Wells once said that we're in a race between what he called education and catastrophe. And I think that's a pretty good way to put this. We are in a race, but I think that we are now moving. We're now, I think, coming into the game. But it's going to be a close call. That's why I call the book Down to the Wire. I think it will go down to the wire.
None of the transformative leaders you mentioned are currently elected officials. Is that a coincidence? They all seem to transformative once they're out of office.
Well,
Anyone in office now?
I think that this issue is first and foremost an issue of governance, not economics, although it's certainly an economic issue. It has economic aspects. It's certainly a technical issue and so forth. But I think it's an issue of governance, and I think it's the way we select leaders and the way we've conducted the public business to allow money to corrupt the conduct of the public business. So if we had to make two changes, we could do them today. One would be to federally fund all elections. You cannot take private contributions to a public office. And number two, open up the public airwaves so that, in fact, what appears on the airwaves is indeed fair and balanced. And there is a misinformation industry that's alive and robust. And I think we can do that and keep the First Amendment and the Bill of Rights intact. But I think we have to reclaim the public commons, part of which is the public airwaves. But that would make it a lot easier for people who are of transformative stature to be elected. I mean, imagine somebody like Abraham Lincoln being elected now. I mean, it would be very difficult. And I don't mean to demean people who hold public office, because there are many, many dedicated public servants. But I think it's harder for them, because if they speak out on these issues, they, of course, offend the people that can provide the money to get them elected the next time around. So I think there are reasons for that.
We're at the point where we just have one last question, and this one from the audience says, what role, if any, will passive and active civil disobedience need to play in the face of continuing governmental inaction on climate change?
Oh.
You know, James Hansen has gone out there and gotten arrested.
He has.
Do you think that we'll see more of that, or should?
I think we should see a lot more of it. And in the case, Jim Hansen was arrested as part of a protest against mountaintop removal in West Virginia. And if there was ever an outrage, it is the practice of cutting the tops of mountains off and taking the debris and filling in valleys, which is going gangbusters right now in places like West Virginia and southern Appalachia. And that's a case where civil disobedience is important. So the short answer to a really good question is yes, I think we're going to need a lot more of it. But it needs to be civil, it needs to be organized, it needs to be disobedient. And in full awareness, you can't cross the lines into violent protests without being counterproductive.
Our thanks to David Orr, Professor of Environmental Studies and Politics at Oberlin College, for his comments today here at Climate One. And now this program is adjourned. Thanks for coming.
Thanks. Thank you.